In 1980, China began its most radical experiment. It introduced the one-child policy, a law that was designed to restrict Chinese families to just the one kid. Now, the thinking behind this was simple. If China was going to catch up with the West, it would have to massively increase its productivity, but also radically curb its population growth. That way, the Chinese leaders figured, there would be a bigger pie, but fewer hands reaching out for a slice of it. But now, after 38 years, the one-child policy is finished. It's been reported in the past week that China is at last planning to scrap their population controls completely, removing all restrictions on the number of children people can have. I don't know if many of us outside of China have given the one-child policy much thought about the ramifications of such a vast experiment, played out in a nation with a quarter of the world's population. I think it's fair to say there was a widely held view that China had made a tough call, but the right one, that the globe couldn't sustain its population growth, and that China was doing a cruel but necessary thing for the planet. But Mei Fong says the one-child policy has been a disaster, and it was never really necessary in the first place. Mei says that once it got started, it was like a runaway train, almost impossible to stop, even though China's leaders knew it would push the country towards disaster. Mei Fong is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. She spent over a decade reporting in Asia, most recently as China correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Mei has spent years uncovering the bizarre story behind the origins of the one-child policy, of the rocket scientists who came up with the idea, and of the ongoing fallout from their experiments. Mei Fong's book is called One Child, China's Most Radical Experiment. I spoke to Mei in 2017 when she was visiting Australia for the Perth Writers' Festival. Hi, Mei.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
This is an amazing work of journalism. I think it's one of the most important works of journalism I've read in some years, Mei. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
It starts with the story of the rocket scientist, the Chinese rocket scientist named Song Jian. Tell me a bit about this rocket scientist, please, Mei.
Well, this rocket scientist, Song Jian, was trained in Russia, and his specialty was missile defense. And if you're sort of wondering why somebody who's trained in missiles would be, monkeying around with women's insides, the answer to that is because China had just come out of the Cultural Revolution. So all the demographers, sociologists, economists, all these people had really suffered under that period. They had been tortured, some of them had been killed. And the lessons of this decade were basically, don't stick your head up. Don't offer any criticism that the government may not like. And the only branch of academia that was left untouched were the defense scientists. They were the only ones who weren't tortured, had the equipment, and the sort of a confidence that they could do this. Now, of course, they were dealing with women's bodies, not the trajectories of rockets, but that didn't occur to anyone that would be a problem at that time.
Right. So maths is objective, and it can solve all these problems. It's just using the data was what counted.
Yes, exactly.
There were all sorts of concerns in the world at large about overpopulation at that time, during the 60s and 70s, weren't there, Mei?
Yes. I mean, China wasn't the only place that was concerned about this. This was the height of the zero population growth movement, the concerns that we would overpopulate our planet and run out of food. The Club of Rome was a gathering of scientists who ran some projection scenarios that basically calculated that by this time, it would be game over for us, in some of their more pessimistic projections. And then there was a Stanford professor, Paul Ehrlich, who wrote this book on population growth, basically saying we need to cut it down savagely. We are overgrowing the earth. So China was not the only place that thought these things, but of course they were the most populous nation, they and India. So these things were very much at the top of their mind.
Yeah. So how did Song Jian, this rocket scientist, pick up on some of these Western ideas about overpopulation?
Well, so a lot of people were discussing these ideas, and there was a Dutch mathematician that I spoke to who had sort of created this as an elegant mathematical model. If on this fictitious island with this many people, what would be the optimum population growth before the island runs out of resources. He did a paper on it. He did it as a pure mathematical exercise. Now, he met Song Jian, and Song Jian apparently was very taken up by these math models. Now, I spoke to the guy, this Dutch mathematician. He said these were never meant to be real-world applications. These were, you know, just interesting, elegant math models. But he didn't know at the time that someone like Song Jian was a senior top government official and that he was going to apply them to a real-world situation in China. You know, human behavior is not the same, right? You have to adjust or account for this. So it is not rocket science to sort of figure out that if you apply these theories to a real-world population, human behavior being what it is, in China, for example, long time known, people value sons. Sons are a very valuable part of the family line. If you tell people only have one, guess what most people will have? They will have sons. And then down the line, you will have no women.
No women.
I mean, it's not rocket science to figure that out, right? Or that if you have, only one and you drastically curtail the size of your children, then at some point you're going to have a big old population and a very small working age population. It's, again, it's not rocket science. But the thing is, the rocket scientists who did this, they thought they could adjust it. They could adjust women's fertility. The way you adjust a lever in a...
Turn it up, turn it down. Right.
So they kind of thought women were like taps, you know. You can turn it up, turn it down. So, you know, Song Jian himself wrote, yes, it could be a problem down the line, but at that point we can just adjust fertility up. But this is the problem, right? 30-something years down the line, they haven't accounted for things like feminism, women working in a workforce, urbanization. All these things have shrunk family size and also changed societal behavior drastically. So now China has transferred to a two-child policy because they are desperate to have more babies now, not less. But it's much harder to turn on that baby tap than it is to turn it off.
So he presented this at a special conference in 1979 in the Chinese city of Chengdu. And he'd used these algorithms, these mathematical algorithms, to project into the future. And this led to the recommendation by him of a one-child policy for China. Was this criticized at the time?
There was very little criticism at the time because post-Cultural Revolution, people were afraid to criticize anything that was, you know, against the party line. And clearly the party was sending signals that they wanted a drastic population reduction. There was one guy I interviewed. He's an obscure economist. His name is Liang Zhongtang. And he is on the record as being the only one who spoke out against it at the time. And he warned of all the things that we talked about, you know, too many women, too many old people without young people to take care of. He said China would be a lifeless society under such a model. And I called him the Cassandra of the one-child policy because all these things that he sort of predicted came to pass, but nobody believed him.
Was there any kind of population policy in place before the one-child policy?
They did. And this is the issue that I think I really want to try and explain to people outside. It's not a bad idea to want to reduce your population growth, especially for a place like China. If you've ever been there, you know it's really a lot of people. You don't want to stand in line for ages. You don't want to have to wait for years to get medical attention or get your kids educated. Yes, scarce resources, population growth, we get that. But the problem was the way they went about it was such a drastic solution when there were clearly other better solutions that were already in place.
Yeah, you liken it to a crash diet, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, you can lose weight in a variety of ways. Do you eat sensibly, diet, you know, run, exercise, all those things? Maybe you don't lose weight so fast, but you don't have so many side effects to your repercussions. The problem with China in this particular case with the one-child policy was they wanted to shed a lot of weight super quickly, and as a result, they have all these repercussions. But yes, China did have a population planning policy already in place that was actually way more successful and much less coercive. It was called the Later, Longer, and Fewer campaign.
Later, longer, fewer.
So get married later, have fewer kids, and space them longer, further apart. And this had been going on for 10 years before the one-child policy, and during that period, there was the sharpest reduction in population growth there. Average family size went from 6 kids per family to 3. So there's a lot of specialists who argue that, you know, China should have just kept going in that model and it would probably have curbed the population growth, maybe not so quickly, but then they wouldn't also have all these drastic issues.
Well, so why, May? Why would they want to do this? Why would they want such a radical change at that moment if the existing policy was already working?
Well, it was a question of economic growth, you know. China at that point was very poor, you know, and one of the things we do credit the Chinese government with is this massive reduction in poverty levels, right, over the last 30 years. But Deng Xiaoping had set a population target goal. He wanted per GDP capita of about $1,000 by the year 2000. And, you know, if you work it out, you know, how do you work out GDP? It's productivity over number of mouths, right?
Oh, okay.
So this is the part where the rocket scientist worked out his calculations and said that he could not get to that level without moving to a one child per family situation.
And that's how you get the bigger pie.
That's how you get the bigger
slices.
Yeah, it's much easier
pie.
To reduce per capita rather than the GDP productivity, right?
So this policy was introduced in 1980.
Yeah.
How long was it intended to last for, May?
They said they thought it would last for roughly about 30 years. But then at the time when I started writing this book about three, four years ago, it had already gone past that sell-by date. It was still going on. And there were a lot of calls for people to sort of end this policy. First of all, you know, it had been going on long enough to shape a whole generation. And it was very clear that some of these problems are already set into place. But it still dragged on. And one of the theories behind it was, you know, it had created this massive bureaucracy that collected lots of money and fines. It was too hard to just take it down overnight, and they didn't want to do it. There was a lot of resistance.
Once it was instituted, were there riots, revolts? I mean, this is such an overturning of such an absolute fundamental family practice.
I think there was a lot of resistance at the grassroots levels. People would hide their children, just not register them, right? So there are lots of registered children in the end that turn out to never receive benefits or get education in school, something like 13 million. And then there were people who would try and move around because one of the things you try to do is to avoid detection, is to carry a child to full term. If you stay in your village, then, you know, the village people who know you will inform upon you and constantly come at you and encourage you to take an abortion. And if you resist, they may actually forcibly take you away. So what you do is you move to some other part of the country where hopefully nobody knows you and hopefully carry the child to full term. So that was another form of resistance. And there were people who tried to do it by having fake marriages, remarrying again, because if you remarry a second time, then that counts as part of your quota.
All right, resets the clock, does it?
Resets
right.
The clock.
Yeah.
Or in a case of multiples, once technology came in and you could have twins or triplets, there were people going for fertility medication because it counts as a live birth, one live birth, if you have two or three.
Obviously, prevention's better than cure when it comes to these matters, May. Was there like sex education, contraception made available, those kinds of things?
There was. I mean, first of all, you know, abortions were very easy to obtain. Contraception was also, but here's the thing, right? The kind of contraception made available to people, well, in many cases, not a choice issue. There was a lot of requirements, for example, after you had your one child, your quota, you would be required to be sterilized. They didn't trust you to just use contraception and not have another child. They would require you to have your tubes tied, have a permanent solution.
What, hundreds of millions of people?
Yes. So it depends on the parts of China, but there were quite a lot of places where the requirement was after you had your quota, you have to show up for sterilization. Or in cases where maybe they give you an IUD, these were specially designed IUDs that could not be removed by the women themselves. They had to be removed by the doctor so that women couldn't just take it off. And yeah, so there was not an element of trust here. There was not an element of co-option to get people to do as, you know, there was just simply this level of people would try and get around it, so we're going to try and make it as hard as possible for them.
Was there sex education, though?
Well, this is the funny part, right? I mean, there's a lot of ability for people to have an abortion. There's not a lot of teaching on what comes into creating a baby. So there isn't a lot of sex education. I do know a lot of my friends who used abortion as a form of birth control. They got pregnant multiple times because they didn't really quite know how A leads to B, and then they would have abortions. You sort of don't teach your children what, you know, how the babies are made, but you tell them how to get rid of the babies.
You mentioned there was an exemption there if you got remarried. Were there other kind of exemptions in place?
Yes, there were. So one child is not theoretically a very accurate name because there were certain sorts of exemptions made. So, for example, if you lived in the countryside and your first child was a girl, you might be allowed to try it for a second one because they knew that a lot of people wanted a son. Another exemption would be, say, if you worked in a dangerous profession, like if you're a coal miner or a fisherman, you might be allowed to have a second child. Or if you are one of China's minorities, let's say if you're Tibetan or Uyghur, you would be allowed to have more than one child.
What was the thinking behind that?
Because they're minorities, fewer of them.
What sort of fines or punishments were put in place there for people who said, well, I'm going to have the baby anyway?
Well, usually the fines were a multiple of between 2 to 10 times your annual household income. In addition to that, sometimes in cases where, you know, you're talking about the poorest of the poor, say farmers or something, and they don't really have that much in household income, enforcers would come to your house and break things. You know, there were cases
where
they had to make it hurt so that you wouldn't break the one-child policy. If you didn't have money to take, then they would take your livestock, your grain, they would make holes in your ceilings, they would maybe raise
gangsters.
Your house. They
this
are.
Is like gangster
yeah,
behavior.
I've spoken to enforcers and they tell me, you know, they take away things and then, you know, and they resell them again. You know, the whole point was birth quotas were the most important target goal. So if you're an official and your area or district over exceeds the quota, all of you are going to suffer. And you were given a lot of leeway to accomplish that.
Who are these enforcers you're speaking of?
Yeah, it's a huge organization and it ranges from the, you know, national level to the state level, all the way down to the grassroots levels. So if you start off at the village level, then you would have what we call the cluster leaders. So these would typically be women who would be responsible for something like 5 or 6 households. It's a part-time kind of a job. And their whole job is to sort of monitor all their people in their cluster. They know when all the women in their cluster are having their periods. They know what kind of birth control they use. They know how many children they have. They'll probably be able to suspect when there might be an unsanctioned pregnancy. They're supposed to be the red alert. So if they hear things happening, then they send the red alert to the higher level. I talked to this woman, for example, who had defected to America, and she was a mid-level enforcer in southern China. And she said her job was to go around to all these places and try and persuade people who were over quota to have abortions or sterilizations. She called herself a monster by day, but a mother by night. And the funny part of it was she herself was breaking that one-child policy because she had a daughter, but she wanted a son. So she secretly adopted a son, which is not allowed for under the policy either. And she hid him away. And in the daytime, she would go. And she talked about like getting people to the hospital, women who were like 7, 8 months pregnant, and then having forced injections to and in some cases, the baby was born anyway, she said. And she said, I did so many wrong things. But in a couple of cases when the baby was born, I just wrapped the baby up and gave it to the father and said, I don't know anything. I don't know anything. Just take it away. And that was her form of trying to salvage something for herself, her conscience. And the thing that all these people I talked to, I asked them, I said, how do you deal with yourself? How do you deal with such a horrible job? And most of them all came back to it. I had no choice. This was my job. I had no choice. I was doing my job. I think that's the same excuse they use at Nuremberg.
Yeah. This is exactly what I was thinking. Even Nazi exterminators had to come up with some kind of moral construction for what they were doing, even if it was a perverse and obscene one. Like, yes, this is a cruel thing I must do, but it's for the greater glory of Germany down the track. That was the kind of moral construction. Were they putting that same kind of moral construction on what they were doing? Like, this is terribly, I'm doing this awful thing and causing this terrible cruelty and distress, but it's for the greater good of China.
Some of them were more cynical. They were in positions of power, and you could, you know, obviously obtain quite huge bits of graft. You know, somebody slipping you a little something, look the other way, or give them a lighter fine. There were some people who were quite committed, and if to live in China is to understand why, because they were saying, you know, China is just so crowded. There's just so many people. We have to do this. Otherwise, we'll never succeed. If you live in life in a countryside, you can see quite hard how hard it is, particularly for women with many children. So some of them, the justification was, you know, the good of the motherland. But, you know, also for many of these people who did do that, at some point it soured when they saw how awful things could be, you know, when they saw, for example, that the rules weren't evenly applied. You know, somebody else could get away by paying a fine and somebody couldn't. And it was sometimes boiled down to the luck. I remember this story that I stuck in my mind. I talked to this guy who was he had been at the start of his career a young government official. And he had been telling me all these stories about how he confiscated stuff and, you know, did all these thuggish behavior. Yeah, we go into the house, we'll teach them a lesson, we'll break a couple of holes in the roof, and we'll take away their pigs and stuff like that. And then I said, and then of course I said, how can you stand to be so awful? Doing this kind of job must be difficult. And then he said to me, you know what, there is one incident that I'll never forget. I said, what's that? He says, well, we knew this woman was pregnant, and she had been hiding out in the next village. I can't remember how big she was, but she was pretty big. And I organized a nighttime raid. They did that a lot at night so that, you know, they could catch these people off guard. So we surrounded the house, and I thought we were really quiet. But she must have heard something because she began to run. And she ran and she ran, and we chased her, and she ran until she went to the pond. And she stood up there, up to her neck in water, and she began to cry. And she cried and cried. And she said that she had to have this child, because if she didn't have this child, her father, her husband would never treat her right. Her mother-in-law would never treat her right. And then I'm transfixed when he's telling me the story. You know, the imagery, this woman in the dark, up in the water, surrounded by all these people circling the water hole like predators. So and I said, so what happened to her? What did you do? Well, he said, we went in there and we took her up. And he didn't say it, but yeah, they took her away for a forced abortion.
Forced abortion?
Yeah.
How commonplace was that?
It's hard to tell the numbers. It happens. It happens more than we think they do. And the case that made the headlines happened as recently as 2012. In this case, this woman was 7 months pregnant. She had been asked to pay a fine that neither she nor her husband could afford. They were both factory workers. They tried to bargain it down. And she got well along to a 7 month when they caught her. And then they took her to the hospital and she had a forcible abortion. And the only reason why we know this is because in 2012, we have social media. So what happened was there was a picture of her lying next to the fetus on a bed. And, you know, the fetus, of course, at 7 months is like a perfectly formed human child. And somebody, I think it was a relative of his, took a picture of that. And it went viral in China. And a lot of people in China were shocked. Because a lot of people didn't know about this, especially people in the cities. This never happens to people in the cities. You never hear of a college-educated woman being taken away for food. These always happens to farm people, people in the countryside, people with the least amount of power. So this, I think, was a turning point in the awareness of what the one-child policy is. And the funny part is this was 2012. And 2016, the government makes a decision that everybody can have that second child. So this sheer arbitrariness of it all, just a few years down the line, and she would have been saved this. Some friends of mine did go back to her and interview her husband after this and said, well, how do you feel about it? Just a few years. Imagine if it just had happened to me just a few years down the line. We would have been saved so much. And why the difference between 1 year and next made such a difference to my life.
Now, you mentioned there was a program of mass sterilization that would often happen after the first child was born. Would that be primarily inflicted on women or the men?
For most of China, it was women. But in an area in Sichuan that I did some reporting on, it was mostly men. So I did some digging around and I found that the reason for that was because there was a Sichuanese doctor who pioneered a method of, it's called the no-scalpel vasectomy. It's still used today.
The no-scalpel vasectomy?
Yes. It apparently doesn't require an incision. So it's very popularly used in third world countries. And it's still used today. So because he pioneered this surgical method, which is quite effective, and he was from Sichuan, so it was practiced quite a long way around it. And I actually interviewed a sociologist who had actually seen it done. You know, he said, you know, they take you, you know, when you're visiting China, they take you to, you know, see all these wonderful things they're doing with birth control. And he said, it takes something which looks like a crochet hook. You stick it into the scrotum and you wriggle it about a little bit, and in about 3 minutes, you're done. And he said, and you know, there was this kind of thing was so popularly done that at some point they would do it in public, in the open, to sort of persuade other men that, oh, look, it's see, it's fine. Come in, the water's warm.
I'm just telling you, I'm crossing my legs right now, and I'm not going to uncross them for about 3 hours, I think, nonetheless. This is the no scalpel vasectomy,
the
is
no
it?
No scalpel vasectomy. Look it up.
That's right. Never recommended to me by my doctor, I must say. There's the terrible story here of what happened to the baby girls who were born before the gender of the sex of the child could be detected before birth. We have heard stories. Infanticide was regularly practiced. We can't know the scale of that, can we?
No, but we can tell you that in terms of actual numbers now, what are the numbers of missing women that China has? So if you look at the numbers, the one-child policy was going on for well over 30-something years now, right? So there are about 30 million men, surplus men, who don't have their numerical equivalents in women. And so if you factor in the fact that nature typically makes more women than men, so there are something in the nature of 50 million missing women in China today. So these are women who were never born, given away, or killed at birth, or ill treatment, or maybe not registered. So that's where you're missing from, and which is the funny part of it. Well, I don't know about funny, but now China wants to do a two-child policy, right? So how are they going to make more babies when they have fewer women? Where are the mothers of today for the workers of tomorrow?
On ABC Radio, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
You were mentioning there before there, May, the obvious gender imbalance now that exists in China after years of abortions of girls in utero, infanticide. The severe imbalance between young men and young women in China. This is where the term bare branches comes from. Tell me a bit about that, please.
The term bare branches refers to men who will never marry. Their brides just aren't there. So they are considered the biological dead ends of the family tree. So you see these bare branches more, I think, in the countryside, because rural men have the worst time of it all finding women. You know, women don't want to live in the countryside when they can live in a city with running water and shops and nice things. So these are the areas where you see the most hard-pressed cases. A couple of years ago, I visited what we call a bachelor village. I was flipping through newspapers looking for some inspiration for stories, and I saw a headline that said, "Runaway Brides in Central China." And then, of course, I was like, my imagination was seized. What are these runaway brides? I visualized them scampering across the paddy fields with their wedding veils rippling in the wind. So I thought, I must go down there and see what's going on. So I went to this small village. It's called New Peace Village. When there's a scarcity of women, especially at that level, then what happens is economics takes over to some extent. So in the countryside, there's always been a sort of a custom of bride price and bride dowry. So dowries are given from the men's side to the girl's side. Bride price is the other way around. And in the old days, in the communism days, it was just, you know, a couple of things, a few changes of clothes maybe. Nobody had much. Because of the shortage of brides now, bride price had come to be a very significant thing, something like 10 years worth of farm income. So if you had a son and you wanted to see him married off, you would probably have to borrow quite a lot of money to make it happen. And in the cities, it was worse because you were expected to buy a place for your son. If you didn't have an apartment, he probably wouldn't be considered so eligible.
Does this kind of explain some of the interesting tension that you see on If You Are the One, which is plays in Australia at the moment, where a wretched young man comes forward and tries to persuade a whole panel of women that he's worthy of marrying or being a partner of?
There is a kernel
bing, bing,
of
bing,
truth.
Bing, 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 saying no.
There is a kernel of truth in that. I mean, just as, of course, you can expect, the Kardashian show to be an approximation of what American family life is.
Right.
Yes, there is that thing. And you don't see it in places like Beijing and Shanghai, where you have quite a lot of men and women, but you do see it mostly in the smaller areas, the towns and the cities. So in this case, I'd gone to this farm city, and these poor guys had all, saved and to marry these women, and these women had set up a scam. So they collected the bride price, and then they skedaddled.
Took off. These are the runaway brides.
These were the runaway brides. And I remember going to the village and talking to one of the bridegrooms. And, you know, I felt sorry for him. He wasn't raving against this, you know, bitch who had stole his money. He was saying, I felt sorry for her. I thought that she was under pressure. I mean, he genuinely sort of had sort of feelings for her. He said that after she had run off, she had called him and apologized. And I'd gone to see him in his home, his family home. And in the middle of the living room was a motorcycle that he had bought her. It was a red motorcycle. He had tied some red rosettes around the handles, and it was still there, a reminder of what he had hoped for. And, you know, these are all men who are probably never going to find women and have families. And life in China, when you're childless, when you don't have families, it's very different, especially at a rural level. This is the way things are supposed to go. You have no standing if you're not married, if you don't have a child. So can you imagine? So you have two confluence of problems. One, a shortage of women. Two, only children syndrome, right? So imagine if you are a parent of one child and he's a son. Can you imagine how invested you must be in what he does?
Oh, yes.
And especially who he marries? And this is reflected in what we call the brides, the sort of classified marriage markets. If you go to any public park in a major city in China, a lot of old people hang out there. You know, they exercise, they like to hang out. And what they started doing in recent years is putting out ads for their children. They put handwritten ads for their children in a park saying, you know, my daughter is 40. She's born in the year of monkey. We're seeking some sort of guy. You can go in there any day of on the weekends and you can see all this laid out there.
Is the shortage of women leading to, just worst case scenario here, to a purchase or abduction of women from surrounding countries like Vietnam or Laos, Cambodia, those kinds of countries?
Yes, definitely. So North Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, a South Korean human rights organization doesn't estimate that some 70% of women, North Korean women in China are trafficked. And they estimate the going rate to be something like $1,500 per woman.
May 2008. This was the year of the Beijing Olympics. You were there in China. And just before the Olympics, there was a massive earthquake in the Sichuan Basin. 70,000 people died. Tell me about how you decided to cover that story. This leads into the one-child policy ramifications quite importantly, I think.
Yeah. So at the time the earthquake happened, I was in a border of China trying to sneak into Burma. I had been trying to get in at a couple of cyclone Nargis that had struck there. And at that point, Burma did not allow any foreign journalists in. I had a Malaysian passport at the time. I was hoping they might, you know, give some ASEAN favorite country status. But no, I was rejected. So I was flying back when the earthquake happened. And when I got back to Beijing, I was kicking myself because I missed a story. This is what journalists do. They want to run straight to that. Most of my colleagues were already winging their way to Chengdu to cover it. I missed that. So I started thinking, how could I cover this story? And I realized that, you know, Sichuan is like, it's very poor and populous. So lots of parts of China have Sichuanese workers. They're sort of their internal migrant workers. Many of them come from there. So I figured there would be a lot of Sichuanese people in Beijing where I was who were worried and trying to go back to Sichuan. So I figured, why don't I find some and I go back with them? I'll follow them on their route. I'll write about their journey. So I went to the train station. I found a group of construction workers, both men and women, and I followed them back. It took something like 3 days, probably the equivalent of between, say, New York and Chicago. And because, you know, the earthquake had happened, we took trains, we walked, we had buses, we took motorcycles, we took boats, you know, all sorts of things. So it was a very long and arduous journey. And the end result of it was not good for most of these people. They went back and they found most of them had lost family members. They, you know, lost property. But the saddest part of it was children. Many children were killed in the earthquake because it was school hour and many of these schools were poorly built. So they collapsed. So a lot, they were called tofu schools. So that was sad. But the even weirder part I noticed was most of them were only children. Because what I later learned was that that area near the earthquake's epicenter had been a test pilot project for the one-child policy before they launched it nationwide. The authorities hadn't been sure that such a tight, painful program would work on a national level. So they experimented in certain areas, and this was one of the areas. So the end result was 30-something years later, not only did people lose their children, they lost their only child. And the first inkling I had of that was when I saw people, you know, just weeks after the earthquake, rushing to the hospital to try and have their sterilizations reversed in a desperate attempt to have that second child before it was too late.
Tell me about the couple you traveled up to Sichuan with.
They were worried about their missing daughter. Hadn't heard anything about her.
And why were they in Beijing living? What were they doing in Beijing?
Well, they were working in a construction strike trying to make some money. You can't make any money on the farm. It's just a subsistence level thing. And for a lot of migrant workers, the push comes when their child gets old enough to go to, say, middle school or high school, and it gets very expensive for them. So they have to earn money for schooling. So they go away, which is a result. China has a huge population of what we call left-behind children. Children whose parents have to go out and work in these big cities, and therefore they live in the countryside and maybe see their parents only once a year or twice a year maybe. And this is all done supposedly for their welfare and benefits, so the parents can make more money. The city rules are such that the parents can't bring the kids with them because the kids will not be eligible for school in the cities. So what it does is this huge demarcation of, you know, so in that case, this girl had been in school and she was killed. And during that journey, I could see they were getting so worried, you know, the trains, every phone ride, day with day, and people, slowly news would trickle in from other people.
While they're on the train.
While they're on the train, but they didn't hear anything from her. So it's just, you know, it was very likely something bad had happened, but the mother kept hoping, you know, maybe she's just buried underground. Maybe she's in an accident and she can't, you know, she's not conscious and therefore can't reach me. So we went all the way to the bitter end, you know, tree. I remember following them up the road to the school, and the road was all covered with red. It was all covered with firecracker paper. This is what they like to honor the dead. So this whole road was strewn with red paper. So it was all red, and we walked up and the mother was crying. And then we got to the school field, which is a total wreck. The whole place, you know, the whole school was leveled. There was just school books, everything lying in the dust. And they went to this guy who was sitting there in the field with a file, and her name was in that. And you know, I can never forget the mother's screaming, screaming and screaming and screaming.
These parents were called, the word is shirdu, is that correct?
Shirdu is a very peculiar term used in China to describe parents who've lost their only child. There's something like a million of them, and every year you get about a couple of 100,000 joining the ranks. And you might ask, you know, why is this different in China versus elsewhere? You know, parents, many parents all over the place lose their only child, not just in China. The thing that makes it difficult and different in China is everything around China is geared around the issue of being a family. So even if you have a child, only one child, it's still, you know, you're still following the social norms. In a countryside, if you are a childless couple, you are so low on a societal totem pole. I interviewed
this. Oh, my God. So you fall down the steps?
You fall down. So I interviewed.
Even though you've lost a child.
People don't know what to do with you. Where do you exist in that scheme of things? So I talked to this couple, for example. This man was 50 and his wife was 45, and their 16-year-old daughter had been killed in the earthquake. And 3 weeks after her death, he had gone into the hospital to have a reverse sterilization. And even though the operation was successful, well, he's 50, she's 45, right? But they had to try. And then when I interviewed them, they said that all their neighbors in the village were avoiding them. I said, why? She says, well, they probably think that, you know, since we don't have any more children, we'll always be, you know, hangers on and borrowing things. You know, we feel so vulnerable. We have nothing.
One of the results of the one-child policy is that China's now too old. That's your phrase. It's too old, as you say. How old is China now?
Well, here's the thing. So by 2050, one in four Chinese will be a retiree. In total numbers, that's more than the population of Europe. If senior China were to form their own nation, they would be the world's third most populous nation after China itself and India. You would be China, India, and senior China.
My God.
Now, and this is nothing to do with the one-child policy. This is simply a function of that cohort of people, that baby
yes.
boom, people born in their 60s and 70s who were old enough to go to the factories and work at the time when China was opening up its economy, who made all those cheap iPhones and things, who are aging and living longer. That's a function of life, which is a good thing in a way. But the problem is the support structure for this huge group of people is going to be that much less because of the one-child policy. So right now, China has something like 5 working adults to support 1 retiree. In a matter of 20-something years, that's going to change to 1.5 adults, working adults, to support 1 retiree. And so that has everything to do with the one-child policy. Now, just to give you an example, I mean, the whole idea of a graying society is not new. It's happening everywhere because we're all living longer, right? So Europe has it too, you know, but Europe has arrived at this after 100 years, maybe a 50. Japan has arrived at this after 50, 60 years. Because of the one-child policy, China has arrived at this at 25 years, half the amount of time. So there's a saying in China, China's going to get old before it gets rich. It simply doesn't have that kind of wealth to deal with this kind of phenomena in a way that Japan has or Europe has. And not only does it not have wealth, it's not going to have bodies.
So the long-term result of this is going to be an economic catastrophe. Yeah. Far from the short term, you get the boom.
Yeah.
Or it helps the boom, I suppose. Or maybe that's spurious too, may I don't know, whether that really did contribute to China's economic boom or not.
I don't think it did. I mean, China's double-digit economic growth came about because of all the lifting of socialist controls, right?
Privatization, you know, of enterprises.
Yeah, you
capital,
know,
investing.
Yeah, they just they let Chinese people be entrepreneurs and stuff instead of making them all work in communes. That contributed to double-digit GDP. And, you know, why was China the manufacturing center of the earth? Because they had cheap labor, and that comes from more people, not less people.
You know, this thing gives me this awful creepy thought that the authorities might at that point decide to have a kind of like a euthanasia program.
For old people?
Yeah, for old people, right? You know, send you off in, you know, if you're not well, perhaps it's best that you don't hang around. What do you
think?
Did
you ever see that science fiction show called Logan's Run?
Yes, I did. Yeah, you have to get killed at 30.
Yeah, you get a great life until 30, but you have to agree to be exterminated after the make room for others. I'm not saying China's going to do that, but it's a hard life for you if you're old in China now, because they don't, you know, the whole network of systems that we've evolved here, hospices, old folks' homes, retirement homes, you know, management, that whole network hasn't really happened in China. It's starting to. But it's still evolving. And it's not going to be nearly anything as big enough to cover the numbers that it's going to.
What's it like to be a Chinese-only child? There's some talk in the West, who knows how true it is, of the little emperor syndrome, where the child is the precious little one and there's no rival siblings. They're spoiled. They're given everything they need. How true is that?
Well, this with social theories, it's always a little hard, right? Mm. I've looked at a whole amount of sociological data on it, and the answer is it's inconclusive. There's been a whole vast body of data that says, yes, there are differences between only child and not only child. And there's some that say, no, there are. And there's some that say, yes, they're positive. They tend to be smarter and whatnot. And some that say, no, they're not. And so it's very inconclusive. But what I did find was an interesting study that was actually done by Australian economists. And what was different about this study was instead of doing behavioral surveys and comparing cohorts where single children and compared with children with siblings, what they did was they compared cohorts, people born before the one-child policy and people born after the one-child policy. And instead of doing behavioral surveys, what they did was they made them play games, games that measured risk, that measured generosity, that measured. And the conclusions they came up with were the one-child generation was much less optimistic, much less generous, and much more risk-averse. Now, of course, this is just one study, but I found it very interesting because the methodology used was very different and it seemed to make sense in some sense. But the one-child generation in China is very different from, say, it's only children elsewhere. Anywhere else in the world, you do not have such a large concentration. This is basically one-third of all households in China and 90% in cities. So everything is different there, and it's very peculiar to China, too. Now, my theory is, and this is what it is after talking to many, many kids, and this little emperor syndrome might be there, but I think it's going to manifest itself as a little slave syndrome eventually, that many of the people I meet of the little child, one-child generation are just in their 30s at the earliest, right, olders of them. And so the burdens of the one-child generation, that you know, huge number of old people to take care of, they're only going to be felt in the next 20 years. But it already is kind of cramping some expectations, right? You can imagine at the level of the things we talk about in China is, okay, exams, huge pressure for you to succeed, especially you're the only child, your parents are, you know, focused on you, you have no siblings to divert that. Second is marriage. And this is reflected in things, even in day-to-day, like work, for example. There are companies that will actually advertise that we prefer to hire people with siblings. We don't want only children. You know, and these, because they'll say, you know, well, our jobs, for example, involve a lot of traveling, and only children tend to have parents who protest if they are traveling too much from home. Or, you know, these kind of things, you know, they will actually say that. And so in a company like Baidu, for example, which is like China's Google, they actually have these things like what they call singles clubs, 单身俱乐部, where they organize mixers for their mostly male, you know, engineers and stuff to meet women. And they send newsletters about this, and some of these newsletters are sent to the parents of their employees so that the parents will be happy and say, yes, you should work for Baidu because they might help you find a wife.
Wow. Wasn't Singapore doing this for a while? Our story is that Singapore, the government was organizing love cruises to try and get people to marry and have children.
Yeah, Singapore, you know, in many ways, Singapore is an interesting macrocosm of what China looks to. Like China
studies Singapore really closely,
So for, you know, and here's the thing. So China, Singapore was also worried about population overgrowth. Can you imagine tiny little Singapore at one point? In the 70s, but they didn't have anything as severe as the one-child policy, but they did have two. Just that's it. Have two, that's it. No more. And then now, of course, they had a process where they're so worried about population growth. It has one of the lowest rates of growth in the world. They're desperately trying to encourage it. And one of the things they want to encourage is also, you know, educated couples to get married. So they used to have this thing called the Social Development Unit, which is a government matchmaking agency tasked with matching college graduates. You know, they have mixers and things. And
the whole idea that the government might get involved in trying to hook you up with you know, some kind of sexual assignation is pretty interesting, isn't it?
Government Tinder.
Yeah, you two, come on, get together. You two need to talk. Come on, you guys, come on.
Well, the funny thing is called Social Development Unit, SDU, Singaporeans call it. So the joke was they called it Single, Desperate, and Ugly.
Oh, man. So as you said right at the start there, that the thinking was at the outset of this policy way back in 1980, more than three decades ago, was that it would be like a dial. They'd turn it down, and then at some points they could crank it up again. But it's more like a tap you can't turn on again, isn't it?
Well, it hasn't happened for most of the world, right? You know, any countries that have issues with falling birth rates have tried to push it up, but it's a very difficult process. You know, Singapore, for example, has tried it.
Well, Australia's trying to solve it through migration, really.
Yeah,
I mean, that's how
which has its own issues too, right? You know, if you have issues with introducing a large alien population with very different cultural values, you might have problems like what you see in France with the issues with the riots in the outer city areas where it's a largely Muslim population.
We've worked it a very different way from France, fortunately for us, I think.
But Australia's a huge country too, you know. Mm. But yeah, so you might think about it in terms of, yes, can you introduce immigration? Some countries are historically not very open to that. China never has been. They have a largely Han population, so it's very interesting to imagine what they would do. The other part is you try and grow it homegrown, right? And that's also a difficult one to do. Scandinavian countries have only been able to raise the birth rates a little bit with very expensive packaging, you know, involving subsidized schooling, parental health care, you know, all these things to induce or encourage women to have more kids. Now, these are all very expensive things to do. I'm not sure China has the money to spend on that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's very hard.
You quoted the author of the one-child policy, that rocket scientist we started with right at the beginning, Song Jian, who co-wrote this book in 1988. And I'm just going to quote from you because you've got it in your book. This is the most extraordinary thing. Since human beings appeared in the world millions of years ago, they have been battling with nature. We have placed the whole vegetable kingdom under our control. We have become the rulers of the entire animal kingdom and conquered all kinds of ferocious beasts that once killed or injured large numbers of our ancestors. Now we have got our revenge on them, using their lives to repay the blood debts they owe us from history. We have tamed the rivers and controlled lightning. In short, we have been the victors. We have mastered the world. We have conquered outer space, and we have won freedom. That's one of the silliest things I've ever read in my whole life. That sort of attitude isn't, of course, confined to China by any means, of course. But the arrogance behind that? The sheer blundering arrogance of that is shocking to me.
Well, if you look at modern China per se, there's this huge belief that you can turn tides literally, right? This is, you know, Song Jian was later on involved in the construction of the Yangtze Dam.
Oh, the Three Gorges Dam.
The Three Gorges Dam. Yeah, so you can, you know, you can bend nature to your will. And this is why we have so many issues with environmental concerns of China, that the nature exists to be bent to the will of the people. So that mindset has created everything from the one-child policy to the environmental degradation that we see.
You have two children of your own now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever wonder how you might explain this story to them one day? I don't know how old they are now. They're still quite young, aren't they?
They're six.
I wonder how you would tell them that story. Would you do it like a fable, I wonder?
Well, I also had fertility issues, and I went to IVF in China, and I write about my time there talking with women there and what they were doing. And the difference that children makes to your life, which is one of the reasons why many people are hesitant now today, right? So now my life is changed a lot. I'm no longer this badass foreign correspondent trotting off to troubled spots. I'm a mother who tells bedtime stories to her children. So the bedtime story I think I will tell my children one day is, you know, once upon a time there was this land. And it was so poor once upon a time that the emperor decreed that everybody should only have one child. And then a great sadness fell over the land. And people did everything for that one precious child they had. They stole, they hid, they stole other people's children, or they sought the help of magicians to make their single child the most smartest, strongest one child that could ever be. And over time, no more babies were born to that land, and it became a country of the old. And I don't know how that story ends yet.
It's been so wonderful to speak with you, May. It's an extraordinary story, and like I say, it's one of the most extraordinary works of journalism in the last few years that I've encountered, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Podcast. Broadcast. And online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feindler. All our conversations are available on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
I spoke to Mei Fong about the one-child policy early last year. And despite China introducing a two-child policy in 2015, the country's birth rate is continuing to fall. And there have been reports from last week that China's now planning to scrap all limits on the number of children a family can have as early as sometime this year. Mei Fong's book, One Child, has met with official censorship in China, so Mei has made it available in Chinese for free, downloadable from her website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.